Hello, I'm Nate Cushman, and I'm here to present to you our system, Cardu, which enables non-expert users to automate tasks across configurations. And this is joint work with my advisor, Dina Katabi. So users are constantly running into things that they want to do with their computers that they've got no idea how to do. They want to do things like sync with their iPod, enable security on their wireless router, defragment their hard drive, tether to their BlackBerry, set up their VPN, and the list goes on and on and on. But you know what's so frustrating about all these? These are all old problems. They've been solved before by hundreds of thousands of people again and again. And yet today, each of us wastes so much time repeatedly solving solved computer problems. And the question is why? If these tasks are being done by so many people, why haven't they already been automated? And the answer is simple. It's because today there's no easy way to automate a task so that it works across all configurations. And our system, Cardu, tackles exactly this problem. It observes a few different users as they perform their tasks and takes a trace of their GUI actions. And then given a few such traces, it produces a canonical solution that can perform this task across a wide variety of configurations. So next time someone else wants to perform the same task, they just run the solution on their machine, and it automatically performs the task for them. Now, to understand the challenge of building a system like this, let's consider a naive straw man. So for each task, let's collect a separate trace for every possible configuration. Now, clearly, we can automate a task now on a new machine by finding a trace that was recorded on the same configuration and just playing that trace back. The problem is that even if we can find the right trace like this, it's untenable to imagine getting a separate trace for every possible configuration, because the space of configurations is huge. People configure their machines in all sorts of weird ways. They have different applications to do the same things. They have different application configs. They turn on toolbars and menus. Or they have different default settings, like calendar view versus email view. And each task has multiple steps, and each of these steps has multiple different ways of doing it, depending on the configuration. And so it's unreasonable to assume that we're going to have a separate trace for every possible configuration. In fact, given the wide diversity of tasks that users are doing with their computers today, we're most likely to have just a few traces for the majority of tasks. And so the real challenge here is, how do we can handle all this configuration diversity with just a few traces for each task? And this is exactly the beauty of Cardu. It generalizes across configurations based on just a few traces. So to understand how this works, let's consider the simple task of turning on out-of-office emails in Outlook. So let's say we have just one trace for this task. The user opens Outlook. They click on the out-of-office menu item. But then at this point, some random pop-up comes up. Let's say the Java Auto Updater. They click it away and continue on with their task. Now, we want to take this trace and use it to automate a task on another machine. OK, so we play back the first step in the trace. The problem is, on this other machine, calendar view is the default instead of email view. And so we can't just blindly play back the next step in the trace. So what can an automated solution do in this case? Now, recognize that even though we only have one trace for this task, we have traces for many other tasks that also work with Outlook. For example, setting up a spam filter. And so it's very likely that one of these traces includes the step of going from calendar view to email view. And because this is just a navigation step, it doesn't actually update the system state, we can safely splice this step into our automated task. And so the first insight here is to recognize that we can differentiate non-state modifying actions from state modifying actions, and recognize that we can learn non-state modifying actions from traces for any task. And because of the huge number of ways that users can navigate the user interface, learning like this from any trace for any task allows us to handle a much larger diversity of configurations with just a few traces. Okay, so now we've gotten to email view. We can go ahead and do the next step. Except the next step now is to click away the Java updater. And clearly, the Java updater is not going to pop up at exactly the same time in the automation machine. So how do we continue at this point? Here, we recognize that clicking away the Java updater doesn't actually update the system state. So again, we can just skip this step and continue on with the trace. And so the second insight here is to recognize that we can skip non-state modifying actions that occur in the original trace. And this allows us to clean these original traces, to remove unnecessary actions, and hence unnecessary dependencies like the Java updater. So in the rest of the talk, I'm going to tell you how we use these two insights to build a complete system. So the main contribution of our work is our system that automates across configurations with just a few traces per task. And it requires no kernel or app modifications. And we've used it to automate tasks from the Microsoft Help and eHow websites. And just to give you a sense of the kind of tasks we're talking about automating here, we're looking at things like email tasks like turning on email forwarding, web tasks like configuring an SSL proxy, office tasks like turning on autosave, networking tasks like setting your machine to use Google's public DNS servers, and system tasks like defragmenting your hard drive. And so our results show that using only two traces per task, Cardu can automate across 84% of configurations. While a baseline, which tries one trace, and then if that fails, tries the second trace, succeeds on only about 18% of configurations. Okay, so now let's talk about the components of Cardu. Cardu has three components. First, it traces user actions, and then it combines together multiple such traces to create a single canonical solution that works across various configurations. And finally, it replays this canonical solution on a particular machine. So let's start with tracing of user actions. The challenge here is that the operating system only gives us mouse click location and key press events, which we clearly can't play across one machine to the other because even a resolution change is going to cause that to fail. And we also can't just hook into the windowing layer because many applications use custom widget libraries to draw their GUIs. So our solution here is to use the accessibility interface. This interface was designed to support screen readers for the blind and is now widely supported by modern operating systems and widget libraries. For each widget, this provides us the type of the widget, say checkbox or button, the value, whether it's checked or not, the location on the screen, the text on the widget, whether, say, enable IMAP, and its location in the window hierarchy, in addition to a number of other features. And we combine all these features together to create a unique identity for each widget. And this interface also allows us to map mouse click and key press events to GUI actions which are meaningful across machines. Okay, so now we've traced these user actions, how do we combine multiple such traces to create a single canonical solution? So the key insight we discussed earlier was to distinguish between state-modifying and non-state-modifying actions. So specifically, Cardu distinguishes between update actions, which create a pending change to the state, such as, say, checking a checkbox, commit actions, which write these pending updates to the state, say, clicking the OK button, and navigate actions, which make new widgets available by, say, clicking on a tab. And clearly, update and commit actions are state-modifying, while navigate actions are non-state-modifying. And remember, this distinction is important because state-modifying actions must be learned within the same task, while non-state-modifying actions can be learned across all tasks. The real question, though, is which actions are which? Specifically, the operating system doesn't give us some label telling us this is a state-modifying or a not-state-modifying action. So how do we map these GUI actions to update, commit, and navigate? And our solution here is to do this the same way a user does. You recognize that an action is, a commit action because it clicks on a button, and that button has one of a few different names, say yes or confirm or OK, and then the window typically closes. And so we want to take advantage of all these kind of visual cues that indicate whether an action is an update or a commit or a navigate. And we combine all these cues together using a machine learning classifier. Specifically, we use a support vector machine which maps from actions to labels, update, commit, or navigate. And a classifier works by taking advantage of a feature vector for each action. So we pick a wide variety of features, things such as the widget's type, whether a window opens or closes, whether some other widget on the screen changes state, and so on. And we also want to take advantage of the text on the widget. And so to do this, we do this the same way the natural language processing community does. We create a vocabulary of all the words we've seen on all the widgets, and then we create a separate feature for each word, indicating whether or not this word appears in that widget. And lastly, we use supervised learning and train our classifier using a small set of labeled data. Okay, so now we can differentiate between state-modifying actions and non-state-modifying actions, but how do we use this information to generalize across configurations? So here's the sort of big picture on how this all works. So we've got multiple traces for each task, and we've identified which actions modify state and which are purely navigation. And now remember, these navigation actions are task independent because they don't modify the state. So we pull them into a separate component which generalizes navigation across all tasks. And this leaves only the state modifying actions, which we pull into their component which generalizes just within a single task. And so now when I want to automate a task on a new machine, the first component will give me the set of steps to perform the task on that configuration. But I can't just play these back directly. These are things like, say, check the out of office checkbox. I need to figure out how to navigate to that action first. So at each step, I query the navigation generalization component, which gives me back the set of actions to navigate to that particular widget. We splice those into the automated solution, and we perform the same step for each state-modifying action in the task until we have a complete automated solution. So effectively, our generalization box really has two components, generalizing navigation actions and generalizing state-modifying actions. Let's start by looking at how we generalize navigation actions. So recognize that a navigation action is purely an action performed on one widget in order to make some other widget available. And so we can combine all these navigation actions together into a global navigation graph, where the nodes are the widgets on the screen and the edges are the actions that move from one widget to another. And we use this graph during replay by starting at the widget we want to reach and doing a backwards breadth-first search till we find some widget that's currently on the screen. And then that the edges along that path represent the actions we need to perform in order to make that widget appear on the screen. Okay, so that's how we generalize navigation actions. How do we generalize state-modifying actions? So remember that state-modifying actions are just updates and commits. And so the first question is, are all updates and commits necessary? To answer this question, consider the following example. Let's say I want to copy and paste a license key from my email into a text file. So I open Word, copy and paste the key, and then I get worried about the formatting in Word and that it's not going to save it the right way. And so I close Word, open it instead in Notepad, copy and paste the license key in, save it in Notepad, and close Notepad. Now, clearly this first update was never committed, and as a result, it's unnecessary. The second update, on the other hand, was committed, and so it's necessary and must remain. And it's very important to remove these unnecessary actions, because if we don't remove this first action, then we cannot replay this trace back on a machine that doesn't have Microsoft Word installed. More generally, unnecessary actions lead to unnecessary dependencies. And so it's critical for us to remove them in order to be able to generalize across various different configurations. Okay, so how do we remove these unnecessary updates and commits? Solution here is pretty simple. Remove any action that doesn't contribute to the final system state. We do this in a two-pass algorithm that's best explained with an example. So let's say a user opens a dialog, checks a checkbox, and then closes the dialog by clicking OK. And then they forget whether they checked the checkbox again. So they open the dialog again, realize that they did check it, click OK to close it. And then they second-guess themselves and decide maybe they don't want to check it. So they open the dialog again, uncheck the checkbox, but then decide finally they want to leave it in the check state, and so they just click cancel. So when we change this to navigate and update steps, it looks like the following. When we drop the navigation, it becomes clear that only the first update was ever committed. And so the second update and second commit are unnecessary and should be removed. So the first pass removes unnecessary updates. It does this by starting at the end and walking backwards so that it sees a given commit before we see the associated updates. So by the time we see an update, if we haven't seen an associated commit, we remove it. Similarly, if we see an update for which we have already seen an associated commit, we leave it in place. And the second pass removes unnecessary commits similarly. And it starts at the front and walks forward so that it sees a commit after it has encountered all the updates which are written by that commit. So here, when it sees a commit for which it has seen an update, it leaves it in place. Whereas when it sees a commit and it hasn't seen any associated updates, it knows it doesn't do anything, so it can remove it. So now we've successfully removed all the unnecessary state-modifying actions, leaving only the minimal signal update and commit in this case. OK, so now that we have just the necessary state-modifying actions, how do we splice these together, splice together the various traces to produce a single canonical solution that can perform the task across many configurations? To do this, we build a graph, and we insert in branch nodes wherever the traces differ in the set of state-modifying actions they perform. The question is, how do we decide which branch to take for a given configuration? For example, let's say I want to change the name of my wireless network. How do I decide whether to follow the steps for a D-Link router or the steps for a Nekia router? Cardew does this by recognizing that different configurations manifest themselves as different GUI screens. So when the user types 192.168.1.1 into their browser, they'll get a different screen depending on whether it's a D-Link router or a Nekia router. So when Cardew does that during playback, if the D-Link screen appears, it follows the steps for D-Link. And if the Netgear screen appears, it follows the steps for Netgear. And so in general, what we're doing is recognizing we don't have to decide a priori which branch to follow, and we can just dynamically evaluate these branches. OK, so now we've generalized both state-modifying and non-state-modifying actions. Let me remind you how we do this replay. So we've got our global navigation graph, and we've got a per-task commit update graph. We look at the per-task commit update graph, and for each step, we run our global navigation algorithm before we perform that step. OK, so now let me discuss the experimental results. We've implemented Cardew as a thin client backed by a server, and we've tested it on the 57 tasks from our eHow and Microsoft websites that I showed you earlier. And we asked a group of users to manually perform these tasks. And to do this, we configured 20 diversely configured VMs, which by changing the application config, the system config, and the set of installed applications. And then we split this into 10 training VMs and 10 test VMs, and then asked a group of users to perform the tasks on the training VMs, such that each task was performed on exactly two of the training VMs. And then we used these two traces to automate the task, using both Cardew as well as a baseline that runs the first that directly runs back the first GUI trace, and if it fails, then runs the second GUI trace. And we tie this on all 10 test VMs. So we first plot the automation success rate for both schemes. The baseline succeeds on about 18% of the VM cross-task pairs. And this is because it basically only works in cases where the test VM is very similar to one of the two training VMs. And it fails even if the test VM is a hybrid of the two. Cardew, on the other hand, succeeds about 84% of the time. And this is because it can splice together the two traces, and it can use the global navigation algorithm for navigation, and because it can remove unnecessary dependencies. OK, so now this is the sort of big picture result. Let's zoom into what this is like on a per task basis. So this graph now shows a separate bar for each task. And for each bar shows the percentage of VMs on which that task succeeded. And we've ordered these according to success rate just for easy viewing. So you can see here that the baseline completely fails on about half of the tasks. And on the other half, it still fails to perform them on most of the VMs. Cardew, on the other hand, succeeds on most of the tasks to perform them on all the VMs, although it still fails about 16% of the time. So let's zoom into that 16%. Four of that 16% comes from navigation mistakes. And this is because our navigation algorithm assumes that each navigation step is independent. And this is not always true. The second 5% comes from missing steps. And this is where some window comes up that we haven't seen before, and we're not sure how to navigate around it. And the last 7% comes from errors in our classifier. And we believe that with more traces and more tasks, we can eliminate a lot of these errors. So in conclusion, I presented to you our system Cardo, which automates tasks across configuration with just a few traces per task. And we've shown that based on just two traces, it can successfully automate a set of 50-plus real-world tasks on 84% of configurations. And finally, we believe this is applicable to a wide variety of problems. This includes automating corporate help desks, automation of repetitive tasks, and automated GUI testing. So, thank you very much.
Hi, Adam Chapala from Harvard. I was wondering how many of these examples you could have handled by just processing the underlying configuration files instead of understanding the GUI?
Of the examples that we tested?
Yeah.
Some reasonable percentage of them, although the idea here is to build a system that works across a wider variety of tasks than just configuration tasks. Things like defragmenting your hard drive or things like configuring your router, for example, in our remote desktop case, we had to configure the router. But it's true that the examples that we tested with, though, a lot of them could be done by something where you could look just at the config files.
Josh Triplett, Portland State University. I was wondering, the system you've built seems very specific to driving GUI applications. I was wondering, to what extent do you think it would be possible to adapt it to perform a task that involves command line steps or to perform a task that involves editing specific files on the system, that kind of a thing?
So the tasks that we have do perform some command line steps, but it's true that it's not specifically designed for that. So in general, we're focusing sort of on the desktop world, where most users do most of their stuff purely through the GUI. It's possible that it could be extended to more of the server world, where a lot of stuff is done more by the command line. But it would obviously involve more text processing and understanding various commands in a way that's much harder to do than with the GUI. So we could definitely extend it, but you would definitely need some new ideas in there to make it work really well.
Dave Lilithan, Georgia Tech. So your training traces, I guess, there's a little question of like who would be performing those. But if you assume that it was just regular users, it's possible some of them could make mistakes during their configuration. So what would happen if you have a limited amount of mistakes in your training data?
So part of exactly what we do is remove mistakes where the user opens something that's not necessary or performs some part of the task which actually doesn't do anything. So we remove those parts of the traces. So what do you mean by?
Well, I mean more in terms of where the user actually misconfigures it instead of correctly configures it.
Yeah, so there's multiple ways you can think about that. So one of the ways that we think about that is by having an additional trace effectively for each task, which is a check, which says, how do I know whether this thing, you know, for example, if I want to set up my email account, I can then go and send an email to myself and see if it comes back or not. And so if we have such checks in place, then obviously we can check whether such a task actually works on a set of VMs in the background and then throw out any traces that don't actually complete the check. The second thing is that if we don't have such a check, then we're going to perform kind of the majority, the one that more traces do. So if say multiple people are doing it wrong, but they're doing it wrong in different ways, we're going to pick the one that's most common. And it actually, when you boil it down to just these state modifying steps, it actually turns out that the commonness is actually pretty common. So,
Thank you.
Hi, Nathan Taylor, UBC. Thanks for the talk. It was insane, and I love it. I have a question about the situations where you have to branch.
Yeah.
So you used the example where you're changing the router configuration. Yeah. It seems like you've taken a hard computer systems problem, and you've now transmogrified it into an even harder computer vision problem. So I'm wondering, how resilient is this in, say, in the presence of D-Link changing their logo from being blue to yellow? Is it resilient in the presence of slight perturbations in the record?
So we're looking at things at the accessibility layer here. Yeah. And so, and in particular, I mean, the most important feature is the first widget that I need to perform that task there or not? You know, there are other features we can look at if there are multiple traces that, say, have the first same widget in them. But for the case of D-Link and Netgear, even if they change their interface significantly, as long as the sort of steps you need to perform to actually do the task are the same, then we'll be able to recognize it. If they change the interface for some unrelated thing, then it won't. It's not going to affect that task.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, my name is Fitz Nolan from Yale University. I'm curious as to how you determine the start of a task. So what if there's a shortcut to set up the out-of-office email? It's just a button on one person's configuration, but there are a set of tasks on another person's configuration. How do you determine they're the same task, but they have a different start point?
So the way we're thinking about the problem right now is basically that users perform a task, and then they say, this is the task I performed, and they upload that to some server or something.
I see. So the people that upload the trace are sort of doing it as a favor to other people. It's not like you're...
Well, you can imagine a lot of scenarios. So one scenario would be the IT guy does this, mm-hmm. and he then goes, and every time he solves a problem for someone, he uploads it to some central place,
right.
and then he just has to label them appropriately. Well, this is the task I was performing.
Okay.
Or, you know, a customer service rep doing the same thing.
And then in the case, the out-of-office email, so the trace has a bunch of steps to get you to the point right before you click OK. But let's say that I type in a different text, like I'm at OSDI in Vancouver, but you know, and then I type that in, and then I click OK. So that's now
part of the trace,
but that's also important for the commit.
Right. So the way that we deal with that is by recognizing that actions where the user performs something on the same widget, but the thing they perform is different. So, for example, I'm editing the text, mm-hmm. but different users are putting in different text. We call that a user-specific action.
Okay.
And so we're going to stop during playback and say, hey, user, you need to put in something specific. Potentially, we can say, OK, the most common thing people put in is blah,
mm-hmm.
But you know, you might want to modify it yourself. You know, or a user could configure their machine to say, always pick the default and play back if you can.
Thank you.
Mm. Hi, I'm Malvika Tiwari from UC San Diego. I think this is a very interesting problem. I'm a CS student, and I myself have faced problems while configuring applications. And the way I solve my problem is basically Googling for the application and my specific configuration. So have you thought about using Google search as a possible learning input to your to Cardu?
Yeah, so actually, we have a... Hotnet's paper last year where we looked at exactly this problem of taking text and trying to say, if we have a little bit of user help in translating that text, can we automatically turn that text into these automated solutions? So yeah, we're looking at exactly that way of thinking about it as well.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, I'm Andy Wunsum from Deutsche Telekom Labs, TU Berlin. I was wondering, so now considering you make a trace in your email program that may well sort of include some privacy-sensitive data, right? You may grasp parts of the address book or parts of messages on the way. So how do you envision, do these traces have to be manually anonymized? Should the user be able to sort of check the trace before he uploads? How do I make sure that I don't upload parts of my private emails when I actually just mean to upload a trace that's supposed to turn on out-of-office reply?
So I mean, in the sort of general case, in a sort of worst-case scenario, that you do need to rely on the user. Although any time that we see two different users enter two different values, then we're going to consider that private data. Now, if we see many users enter the same value, then again, we consider that to be something public that we can reveal on playback. But if different users are entering in the different data, then clearly, you know, and obviously if they're entering the same data, then at some level it's not that private.
But it still means I have to trust sort of the operator that collects the traces to that he will sort of remove my private data if he sort of sees it. I cannot sort of...
Oh, I mean, you have to trust the automated system, not the administrator.
Basically.
I mean, obviously, yeah, in the same way that you have to trust Google with your email and so on and so forth. Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
So.
Let's thank our speaker.